Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. What is an open society? I posed that question to Diana Morris, who is the director of Open Society Institute Baltimore, a philanthropic organization dedicated to finding solutions to urban issues that impede opportunity and justice. Open Society Institute Baltimore is the only U.S. field office of the Open Society Foundation, founded by billionaire philanthropist George Soros. Here in Baltimore, Diana and the office focus on issues like lowering suspension rates for kids in school, providing accessible drug treatment, and reducing the number of Marylanders in the criminal justice system. Social justice and human rights work have always been important to Diana, who grew up in a small town with an itch to get out and see the world. We spoke about some of Diana's travels and the early issues that got her involved in this kind of work. We also talked about the learning curve Diana experienced when she first got to Baltimore, the challenge of convincing people that these issues are central to all of our lives, and about the city's future. Here's our conversation. Diana, thank you for coming in.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Quinn.
So what is Open Society Institute Baltimore?
We're part of a big national and international foundation, but here we're really a group focused on justice and opportunity in Baltimore. And we're able to use a whole range of different approaches, everything from grant making to advocacy and education, to really bring about big change that gets to the roots of some of the problems that facing our city and, frankly, facing many cities across the country.
Can you tell me about the start of Open Society Institute Baltimore, how the idea came about and its founding?
Well, it's a good story. The Open Society decided to have a program in the United States probably back in 1996. And then about a year and a half later, decided that it might be a good idea to work in a few cities to really get a sense of what change is going on and what possibilities exist in cities. And one of the places under consideration was Baltimore. And as part of that effort, an advanced team came to me and I was ultimately asked to open the office. So that office opened around my kitchen table to be in the early days. And very slowly, we built up a staff and built up a wonderful board. But the idea is to really go deep. And in fact, we're still the one and only field office that the Open Society has in the United States. And we chose Baltimore, I think, for lots of very good reasons, that all of which have panned out. It's a very typical city. I think it's pretty honest about its problems. There's relatively good cooperation between government and community groups. I think there's a willingness to adopt solutions or approaches that other cities use, that there's not a feeling that we have to sort of originate all new ideas. And I think that serves us well. So, you know, in all these years, we've focused on a number of issues. Some of the ones that we focus on now are the ones that we started in the very beginning. And I do think there are issues that really go to the heart of some of the things that need to be changed so that everyone can really participate in the city.
And are you the one who has always been choosing those issues and directing the focus of the Institute?
Well, honestly, in the very beginning, and it was just me in the very beginning, did a lot of asking, what are the important issues? Who's doing what? What are some of the ambitions that we should have for this city? And I think those kind of conversations have always continued. As we've added staff and over time, of course, board members have changed, that's the kind of conversation that keeps on going. One of the hallmarks, I think, of our institution is to be very self-reflective and to ask ourselves, you know, what are the things that we're doing that are working, what isn't, what needs to be tweaked, but also to constantly be aware of the changing external circumstances. On one hand, maybe another funder comes in and is doing work in an area we don't need to be there anymore. Maybe there's some real opportunity because changes in government to get certain kinds of things done. So we're constantly trying to have those kinds of conversations that help us figure out where can we really play to our strength? Where can we provide some leadership? And, you know, obviously none of these things can we do by ourselves. We have to do them in partners with others. We're trying to take on really big issues, and there's no way that it can only be about us. But on the other hand, we want to work in areas that we can really push forward. We think in a progressive way. We're willing to take risks. And so we want to place ourselves focusing on issues that really play to our strengths.
Tell me about the name. What constitutes an open society?
Well, it's a great, great question, and it's one to which there's endless numbers of answers. The phrase actually came from Karl Popper, a philosopher, and it was someone with whom George Soros, who's our original benefactor, studied at the London School of Economics. And I think the idea, and it's something that Soros himself has pondered and written about very many times, is this idea that you have an inclusive society, that it starts with this acknowledgement that we all have imperfect information and that we're all trying to get the information that will allow us to make better decisions. And so for that to happen, you really need to have a society that respects every individual. You want to have a business sector that's really robust and can provide real opportunity to individuals so that they can be economically stable. You want to have a government that's transparent and responsive. And we do believe that there is a real role for government to play, that there should be a safety net, and there are real responsibilities that government has to protect its residents and citizens. And then you want to have a civic sector that really is inclusive. There are people who not only can speak up, but they can speak up in their own voice. Sometimes we have advocates that speak for other people, but what our goal here is to really build up the capacity so people can speak directly for themselves. So I think when you have all of that together, you begin to create an open society. And in many ways, it's synonymous with building a democracy that's really strong and alive, where people feel that they count and that they're seen and recognized.
Before you came here in 1997, what kind of work were you doing?
Well, I was actually in East Africa, living in Nairobi and working in Kenya and Uganda and Zimbabwe. I was working at that time for the Ford Foundation. And after working first in New York globally on refugee and immigrant rights issues, I then had a wonderful opportunity to go to one of the field offices of Ford and work broadly on human rights and social justice issues. And we stayed there, and I actually, my husband-to-be followed me to Africa, but I followed him to Baltimore, and he was asked to be head of the Africa region for Catholic Relief Services, which had been newly recruited to come to Baltimore, and so that's how I ended up here. And then had the ability to work for a set of family foundations, the Blaustein Philanthropic Group, so that was another good experience.
Where are you from originally?
Very, very small town in western Pennsylvania, Altoona, Pennsylvania. I sometimes see it on the weather maps here in Baltimore, so that always thrills me that we're on the map. but it's a small town to which I continue to return. You know, one big high school, that used to be two junior highs, lots of football and so on. So that's where I grew up.
And what was your childhood like, and what did your parents do?
Well, my mother was a homemaker, but very, very involved in the community. She started an association that brought really incredible, talented musicians to Altoona. So for a very small fee, especially now when I think about what tickets cost, you could subscribe and see just top jazz groups, Ladysmith Black Mambaza, jazz groups, opera, Beverly Sills. I mean, it was fantastic. And I had the great opportunity to meet a lot of these artists personally because we often had a reception for them, or my mother would be behind stage making sure that they had cookies and whatever else they needed to feel welcomed to this small town. And the concerts took place at the high school. So she was very involved with that, and then other kinds of things like children's services and so on. And my father joined with my uncle in a business that had to do with coal mining. So that's sort of where we grew up. You know, I think it's a town that is predominantly white. There are some African Americans who were very much in the minority. I guess I was a different kind of minority, religious minority, growing up Jewish. So I think some of those things were formative experiences, actually beginning to think about social justice issues.
Did you always want to get out of the small town, or did you enjoy growing up there?
I enjoyed growing up there, but I definitely did want to move and not think that I would be living and growing up there. It's true. I think I wanted to be a place where I could have much bigger mix of cultures. You know, I was very excited when I was able to live overseas, and I'm happy that one of my daughters is actually working overseas right now. I just thought that I wanted to sort of see the world and just learn about lots of different kinds of people and not feel that it was such a small place as Altoona actually is.
Where do you think you got that travel bug and wanting to see more? Because many people are just content with the upbringing that they had. What kind of gave you the sense that there was more out there?
Well, you know, my grandparents, particularly on my father's side, traveled a lot. I had lots of postcards and dolls, and everywhere they went that we would sort of hear about that. And I think that just really intrigued me. And so I wanted to follow. On the other side, my grandmother immigrated to the United States when she was 13. She came all by herself, which was, you know, she was the youngest of a very large family and obviously made her own way. So I think I just had a sense of being connected to other parts of the world and in many different ways. I mean, on one hand, the whole immigration experience. On the other hand, you know, having the ability to travel and really enjoy the arts in other cultures, but also really getting to know people elsewhere.
Do you remember your first experience with social justice or the first human rights issue that really captivated you or
impassioned you? Oh, I definitely do. Yeah, absolutely. I was actually part of something that is it's called the Federation of Temple Youth. So it's a Reform Jewish youth group that exists across the country and is divided up by state and so on. And I became involved with that. And I think I became involved too because it was a way for me to meet people across the state and again, learn about issues. And it's very much focused on social justice issues. And I remember some of my colleagues from Pittsburgh really introducing me to the boycott of grapes. And that was the work that Cesar Chavez was leaving. And I just got very involved with that. And that was probably the first time I got really connected to something that was really a national movement. But there were other things, too. I was president of our student council. I reported to a man who had been a colonel in the Army. And I remember one of the things I wanted to do is rather than raise a lot of money for a Christmas tree, which, of course, if you think about civil liberties, maybe shouldn't have been a goal anyway of a public school. But at that time, there was the Biafra war going on, and I really wanted us to give money for that. So that was something that did not carry the day. It was something that didn't seem to be a very popular choice, regardless of how much we tried to talk about the situation. But I think that was another kind of thing I started doing when I was in high school. And even small things, we established a place for students to go when they weren't in class. And with that, there were some real restrictions on what we were allowed to paint on the walls. I tried to contest that. It was even a place where we were locked in the school during certain hours. You just couldn't literally leave the school building, and we contested that. So I think there were plenty of opportunities to try to think about student rights, farm worker rights, and so on when I was there. And so it all started, and I think it was really propelled by this concern with social justice.
And what about those experiences felt rewarding to you at that time?
Well, I think it was realizing that there was a whole world out there of activists, and they weren't all living in Altoona. That was true. Certainly, there were some. But I think just feeling connected to some of these other people who were very smart, very strategic, really engaged. And, you know, this idea that everyone counts, everyone should be respected, everyone should be treated fairly. And simply learning more about some of these situations, some of the living conditions that people had to put up with, ways in which people were really being taken advantage of. And that motivated me. But I think it was really getting the sense that there was a whole world out there of people who were activists, and I could be part of that, and we could really bring about change.
Was it clear to you that that's what you wanted to do with your life's work, or did you think that was maybe just something you'd do on the side of whatever your career would be?
Well, I think I really wanted to be an anthropologist. That was what I studied in college. And I think that was something that I wanted to do as another way of really getting to know other cultures. But ultimately, I went to law school and I wanted to combine the two. And at that time, there was a lot of talk about development. It was a time when some of the countries in Africa were relatively newly independent. And there was a lot of talk about what the law could do to bring about change. I think people soon realized that that just wasn't sufficient. But I had the opportunity after going to law school. I worked one summer at the UN. That was, I think, really interesting. And then I ultimately got a job being a legal advisor in the State Department and ultimately actually worked as the first lawyer for a new bureau, which was the Refugee Bureau. And there was a new law that had been enacted that put the U.S. in compliance with an international treaty on refugee rights. So that was fun. I was a young lawyer and the first to interpret that law.
What was your experience in law school like?
Law school, I found not a very good experience. I started out first at Boston University Law School, and there was a lot of things that had to do with widgets, and I actually had just no idea what a widget was. And so that was very confusing to me and also not very interesting. And I was just really struck by this notion that law schools had that they were going to kind of reconstruct the way you think. I didn't find that very appealing. And so I went through 2 years of that. I was on the law review and was able to do some work having to do with treatment of people who were in a large institutions for the mentally ill. And I think and was able to actually do some of that work when I transferred to New York University Law School. And I found that much more satisfying. In between, I actually took a year off of law school and studied anthropology at the graduate level at Princeton just as a special student. I think that gave me the time off I need to sort of get redirected, get happier about what I was studying. And by the time I then did my last year at NYU, at New York University, I think I was much more in sync with what that school's all about. It's really focused on public interest law to a large degree. I was able to select the courses that I wanted that were more consistent with my real interests, and then also had exposure to some international law, and that, of course, then led to my working at the State Department. So it wasn't always a happy experience, especially the first 2 years.
Were a lot of your peers pursuing similar things to you? I don't know anything about the law school environment, so what kind of reception were you getting for wanting to work in nonprofits or do the kind of work that you're doing?
Well, I mean, there certainly were some people who ultimately worked for nonprofits, but it wasn't part of the real culture there. I think it was at New York University Law School, and that was one of the big differences. I don't think when I was applying to law schools that I was sort of aware enough of the differences among them. And it wasn't the predominant culture. A lot of people were really trying to work at big law firms. And I did that actually one summer, and it was kind of fun because it was at the time when that particular law firm had a case before the Supreme Court, and I worked on that brief. And if you're going to, you know, work at a traditional law firm and have, you know, that experience, that's a pretty good way to sort of see some of the more glamorous parts of the law. And it was a big antitrust case and so on. But ultimately, I think I really wanted to be working much more on human rights issues. And since then, I feel like I have in lots of different angles. Even when I was at the Ford Foundation, all of us were lawyers except for the head of the department, who was an anthropologist. And it became a tool, a background. It helped us understand what some of the issues are and what some of the tools would be that some of our grantees could use.
And how and when did you make the transition to nonprofits?
Well, it's funny. I was working at the State Department and, again, you know, being the lawyer for the Refugee Bureau. And it was a time when the U.S. was actually interdicting people on the high seas, including Haitians. As you probably know, there's always been a preference for Cuban refugees. They basically hit the U.S. and automatically get refugee status, but not the case for Haitians. And my feeling was that the kinds of questions that people were being asked when they were intercepted on the high seas really weren't consistent with human rights law. They really were not being asked in a way that would be well understood by them whether they wanted to seek asylum. And a lot of those people were turned back. And I just felt increasingly uncomfortable being at the State Department. And very luckily, I had a colleague I had met when I was at New York University Law School. He actually co-taught a course. And he was working at the Ford Foundation, and I connected with him. And just at that moment, the Ford Foundation was establishing a program on refugee issues. And they had already hired two people. And the good news was that they basically created a new position for me to focus on protection issues of refugees and immigrants. So it was a very exciting time because we were developing a program. I'll say the unfortunate situation is when I look at the programs that Open Society Foundations has or Ford, some of the very same issues are still with us. We certainly can see it's as controversial as ever. Comprehensive immigration reform was not a success. You know, I feel really badly that this many years have gone by and we still haven't moved forward on that issue. But it was an exciting time back then because we had a lot of hope that there would be a lot of change in the near future. And the refugee law that had just been passed by Congress meant that there wasn't going to be preference giving to people who were fleeing communist countries, that instead people would really see and ask, do you have a well-founded fear of persecution, regardless of what country you were coming from?
Speaking of immigration, I am curious what frustrations come with your job. And when you say some of these issues are still with us, I mean, can you just tell me about that?
Well, there's lots of frustrations that come. I mean, and if we focus on Baltimore, you know, at the Open Society Institute, we focus on three big areas. We're focusing on criminal and juvenile justice reform. We focus on education with a particular interest in kids who are at risk of being pushed out of school. And we focus on making drug addiction treatment readily accessible. And in all those areas, we have made progress. But we have to remember that there's been years and years of disinvestment. There's been years and years of policies and practices that really have not made treatment readily accessible, have really built a system of incarceration that has engaged more and more people. I mean, the well-known facts that the U.S. incarcerates more people in absolute numbers and by percentage than any other country in the entire world. And we see the impact of that here. It's highly destructive. The prison system sort of blew up and expanded dramatically in the 80s and 90s because of people who were arrested and incarcerated because of drug offenses. And a lot of those people really needed to be in treatment. Some of them, of course, were not addicted and are drug dependent and were simply selling drugs as a business. But that points to another issue. I mean, in Baltimore, unofficially, we probably have 40% unemployment in certain neighborhoods. So I think when I feel frustrated by issues still being with us, with people not sort of recognizing that the human destruction and the community destruction that happens with existing policies, I just remind myself that it took years of sort of disinvestment to get where we are. And so we're just going to have to plug away for years also. We look at some of the neighboring counties like Montgomery County. A lot of people are doing very well there, but that's because there's been investment year after year in their futures. We have to remember that and really think, how are we using our public money? How are we using our resources? Are we using them in a smart way? Because there's really common interest here. It's really not about a certain small group of people. It's really citywide, region-wide. You know, we can't compete as a region if we don't have a strong workforce. And we can't have a strong workforce if we don't have people who feel welcomed in schools. We want to create schools that really make every kid feel like they're known and they matter. And if they have issues at home, that there's a place to really talk about them and have a sort of transition period where they get then into the groove of learning and feel safe in that environment. And those are very concrete things that we all can do.
Is it difficult to convince people of that common interest?
Yes, it sometimes is. And I think in Baltimore, that happens often because of this hyper segregation that we have in housing. I mean, it's actually easy to not see it, literally not to see it. You can go to your neighborhood and establish a kind of pattern of your life that avoids certain neighborhoods altogether. And so whatever kind of narrative you have in your head isn't challenged in any way. You know, we hear a lot about that these days, about how people with the internet and with the browsers they use and so on, with the algorithms that are in place, basically are just seeing information that affirms what they already believe, and we're not challenged. So I think that there's actually a responsibility we all have to deliberately go out of our way to sort of see what is out there. And I think that kind of activity is actually a responsibility that we all have, especially when you live in a place that where we know we have had a history of housing segregation. And I've just been struck by how in these neighborhoods where we have concentrated poverty, there's so many ways in which people are literally immobilized. They can't get a house in a neighborhood that gives them opportunities to be closer to good jobs, to be closer to maybe better transportation, to be involved with better schools, to have different kinds of role models, different kinds of experiences. People just get so stuck. And that is not some kind of individual bad karma. That really is something that results from the kinds of policy we've had in place here and lack of attention we've had and a certain lack of outrage. You know, I think that's some of the things that we see, that the more people got out of their way to try to learn what's happening in their own backyard, the more they'll see that actually the whole place could be safer, happier, richer. And so in your own common interest, there's a lot of reasons to push for change.
Can you recall any moments when your worldview was challenged in that way, or when your eyes were opened up to something that was going on in your backyard?
Well, I can think very distinctly, and I would say I'm fairly embarrassed thinking about it. When we first opened the office, there was a reporter who did a piece on our opening the office from NPR, National Public Radio. And at that time, we didn't have an office. I remember we literally sat down on the floor together, cross-legged, and had an interview. But when I think back about how much I didn't know then, I'm really kind of embarrassed about it. I've learned a tremendous amount from the staff that we've hired, who are, I think, really exceptional, from our grantees, from policymakers with whom we try to work really closely. And I think I have a much more nuanced understanding of what's going on. At Open Society, we talk a lot about race and racial discrimination and implicit bias. And I'm certainly a product and a victim of all that, too. I mean, I have blinders on, just like so many people do, who just haven't really experienced racism directly. So I can read about it, but I think it's very different if you've actually experienced it. And I think over time, getting to know many more Baltimoreans, getting just to have the conversation of with people who trust me and with whom I develop a relationship, I'm able to hear much more about these experiences and understand the kind of lens with which people see and feel different kinds of slights. And I think that's one of the things I've realized, that in a very profound way, is people with whom you have a lot in common, colleagues at work with whom you've had a lot of shared experiences, you read the same articles, you attend the same meetings, that some interaction with another human being can feel radically different because of your own background, because of all the other slights that you've experienced before. And I think that's something that it's really important to remember as a person who's white, who's had a lot of privilege and a lot of opportunity just to simply walk away from things that feel uncomfortable. And there's many of us in this city who absolutely cannot walk away from that. Sometimes it's a class issue. Sometimes it's really not. It has to do with just race and ethnicity, regardless of how much money or education you have. And I think that's where I've learned at a deeper level just how pernicious and damaging, hurtful racism is. At a very personal level, even if it's structural racism, even if it's not just because someone is sort of out to get you, just things that people do because that's the way some institution is set up, it's just extremely hurtful. And I think that's something that you only learn over experience, but you only learn by really making friendships and deep relationships with people who aren't like you.
When you arrived in Baltimore and took this job, what were your preconceived notions of some of the city's problems, and how did those change, or how were they confirmed?
I have to tell you that I knew almost nothing when I was coming here. You have to imagine the situation. I was working in, as I said, in Nairobi, very engaged, trying to keep track of political developments in at least three different countries. It was a moment of tremendous excitement. For example, in Kenya, it was the first time when there was going to be multi-parties. Before that, there really had been just one party. It was also a time when I was meeting incredibly brave people who were putting themselves at risk because unpopular activities were often greeted by President Moi at that time in Kenya by simply detaining people, locking them up, and people didn't even know where they were. And some of our grantees at the Ford Foundation then were really, really brave and really were changing what was possible politically there. So suddenly, and there I was also having my first child, newly married, very, very pregnant, and my husband having this opportunity to take on this role as being head of Africa for Catholic Relief Services. So we moved to this place, Baltimore. And, you know, I was changing way too many things at one time. City, job, role, suddenly becoming a mother, and so on. So I must say, I didn't have a lot of preconceived ideas. I was just sort of at that moment working on the day-to-day basis, trying to sort of just adjust to all these kind of new surroundings and new roles that I was taking on. But I was lucky to have this job with the Blaustein Philanthropic Group a little bit after being here. And it was a way, because they fund so many different kinds of things in the city, it was a way to really get aware of sort of my surroundings. And I am eternally grateful for the Association of Baltimore Grantmakers that provided me with some colleagues and a way to really hear from panels of people who were doing important work. And I'll say, you know, that's been the thrill of philanthropy all along. I mean, I've stayed in it, obviously working at different kinds of foundations. And always I'm drawn to it because it's this amazing opportunity to learn. When you're in the foundation world, people want you to understand why their work is so important. And these are people who are often at the cutting edge. They're doing things that are very strategic. They're very clever. They're in it for the long term. They really struggle. It's not all good news. They have setbacks. And they're willing to tell you all about that. And for me, I think that's been what's been so invigorating, really, about being in the philanthropic world. So with Baltimore, I think I had just a tremendous amount to learn. You know, everything from topography and the difference between East and West Baltimore, learning about the growing Hispanic community, understanding about families who have lived here forever and ever, the kind of pride that people had, learning literally about different things like drug addiction. I didn't know very much about a lot of domestic issues. I had really focused on a lot of international issues. And obviously, there's a connection between the two very dramatically if you're talking about drugs. But I didn't know really about insurance and Medicaid and some of the shortcomings of some of the systems we have set up. So for me, it's been this amazing education, and I have many, many people to thank for that. But I do feel really strongly that, you know, Baltimore, of course, has many idiosyncrasies of which we're very proud. But in many ways, it is like many other cities across the country, and we have to remember that, that it's not about a particular group of people who are falling behind. There's, in fact, a national phenomenon here, and Baltimore is just part of that. And if we want to have a group of people who don't feel fully part of society, there's something we can do about it. But that kind of work has to happen locally, I think, in many cases. So that's what's kind of fun about being in an office that's really focused on a city. You know, here I am, part of this international foundation, working in many, many countries. We also have a national office, which lets us, you know, draw on all sorts of resources. But in the end, especially when you have a Congress that's so blocked, so much of the work that has to be done in to change the experience of people's lives is at the local level. So I'm just really happy to be working here. I'm learning a lot.
Besides the obvious differences, in your personal experience, what are some of the pronounced differences between doing philanthropic work abroad and at home?
Well, I will say that when I'm hiring, I always give, you know, extra points to a person who's had international experience. I think it's highly relevant. I think if you're someone who's worked on development issues, you understand that philanthropy, I think good philanthropy, can't be about a project. You know, I mean, a project to me is not very interesting. We're really, you know, at Open Society, we often say we undertake campaigns. And, you know, what that really means is that we have to work on something on a multi-year basis, that you have to establish, I think, big goals. And in the meantime, of course, you have to have a way to measure, are you on the right track? Because you could think some strategy is going to work and it just absolutely won't. So I do think that understanding just how something can, in a good way, build on itself, which you often learn when you're overseas, and how you really have to focus on capacity building. You know, I think it comes easily to people that when they're working in some of the developing countries that there's a lack of infrastructure, there's a lack of capacity, and so it's not that hard to pay attention to that. But sometimes here in the United States, we just don't remember that. We focus maybe on reaching a particular issue or policy change, but we don't sort of simultaneously focus on, well, what's the infrastructure like? Is it, after this is done, is something stronger going to be left behind? And who are the people who could actually lead this? I mean, they may not be quite ready yet, but what could we do to actually make them be in a stronger place or better connected with a number of other people in town so they could actually have more power and actually be heard in a way that's louder? So those are some of the things I'm actually focusing on that are similar or crossover issues. I think when you're in your home country, you do, in the end, have better access. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of unusual about Open Society is that, yes, we're a grant maker, but we're actually encouraged, authorized, whatever you want to call it, enabled to be an advocate in our own right. And, you know, we do want to be sure that we're not taking someone else's place. And there may be someone else who actually knows better, frankly, has a better perspective than we do. But in some cases, there is a real role for us to sort of speak up. And I think you're able to do that in a way that's more legitimate when you're in your home country. I think there's some real limitations to doing that when you're overseas. There may literally be restrictions on that. And you would be working in a much more formal way. You know, making formal requests or working, let's say, with an international or regional body that might have some authority, but all that's formal. And I think what's important when you're working locally or in your home country here is that you can use all sorts of approaches. I think it's very important to work for formal change. I mean, if you don't, for example, with change laws, you can be absolutely blocked from having your rights recognized. There can be something that, as it's implemented, is really unfair. So that's important. But what we also realize is that's just not enough. I mean, first of all, you have to see, even if you have some wonderful victory with a law being changed, is it implemented well? Or even was it drafted well? Because you may have just missed something that really needs to be rectified. You know, certainly we're hearing that with the Affordable Care Act, as wonderful as it is, there are things that did not address keeping prices down. And, you know, if there were an opening to change that, that would be really important because so many more people do have insurance now, but it may not always be something that people can afford. And so we have to make some changes there. But the other thing we realize is just what do people believe? You know, you don't want to just have a law that's changed, like the work we've done to try to reduce suspensions. You don't want to just simply impose that on people. You can do that. But when you do it that way, you lose, obviously, the buy-in of some of the key people, like principals or teachers. But you also, when you don't have their full understanding, their full buy-in, you lose their creative efforts. And I think that we all do better when you actually have this inclusive process. And so from a foundation, we absolutely do work for formal change. But there's a lot of informal things we have to do, too. And some of that just has to do with people having different kinds of experiences so that they can sort of see things differently. You know, in the case, again, of just using discipline as an example, it's not that you can no longer discipline a child. We're talking about not suspending a child. And there may be other ways to manage the classroom that just engages the child differently to begin with. And some of that just has to be made accessible to teachers and principals so they can actually think differently about their role. So it's a very comprehensive approach that you can take. And I think, you know, a lot of that you can do more easily in your home country than you can when you're working abroad.
Open Society Institute Baltimore was founded as a bit of a social experiment.
I would say it was an experiment in the sense that we wanted to take risks and we wanted to learn at the same time. So it was an experiment in the sense that we absolutely didn't know what the solutions are. And in some cases, we didn't even know what all the questions are. So I think that's correct. And I think that some of that spirit, we really work hard to retain. We certainly, you know, this idea of fallibility, we certainly don't have all the answers. And we try to really engage a lot of different groups. I think our board is fine when things don't go well, as long as we're really paying attention to what happened that we didn't expect. You know, why did something not go well and what can we learn from it for the next time? So in that sense, a sort of experimental quality to our work, I hope, isn't just at the beginning, but just, you know, kind of permeates the approach that we take.
Yeah, experiment, of course, implies trial and error. And you have been with the Institute since the beginning, especially early on. What were some of the successes you were finding? What were some of the failures?
We've tried to do certain We used to work in the workforce area. I think we've been able to introduce some approaches that now have been commonplace across the country. For example, really focusing sector by sector, you know, looking at the financial industry or looking at the health industry and understanding the particular dynamics within that sector and then saying, okay, knowing what we know, where are the job openings? What's the kind of preparation people need specifically for the health sector? And we were able to do that in ways that has really created ladders for people to go and get into those fields. And of course, we have hospitals, for example, including Hopkins, that have been really good about hiring people with criminal records and realizing that that has nothing to do with a person's performance. So I think that has been one area of success. I think in the area of addiction, part of what we were able to do early on was to dramatically increase through advocacy the amount of money that the state was giving the city. And we were able to expand the treatment system, actually double its capacity. Now, it still wasn't enough. But in those early years, the waiting lines for treatment were just out of sight. You know, we couldn't even dream of trying to do some kind of communications, you know, campaign to get people to think about going into treatment. The demand was already so much outstripping the capacity, the supply. And we're in a completely different space now. I mean, part of that is because people have insurance. There's many more incentives now for some of the treatment centers to expand. So, I mean, I think we're seeing some real progress there. I mean, in terms of things that didn't work as well, I mean, there's certainly many instances of that. We tried at one point to develop kind of neighborhood initiative, which would allow people to get treatment and then go back into that neighborhood and have the support that they needed. And it just, I think, was too complicated a project for it to really survive. So I think that you know, we've learned from that, that sometimes you have a good design, but there isn't quite the capacity, or you don't have sort of a shared understanding of what the goal is among all the players. So, you know, I think that in every single field, there's been successes, but also times when we just haven't really hit the mark.
How do you think most Baltimoreans perceive the issues that Open Society is working on? Are they aware of them? Do they feel hopeful about the work? Do they feel helpless? And what's the sense you get of the residents in the city?
Well, on one level, for many years, I would say that our first 8 years, we really didn't talk very much about ourselves. We didn't want to name a project after ourselves. We wanted other people to take credit for it, the government officials with whom we were working, the nonprofits, and so on. And then starting, I guess, 8 years into our existence, 2006, we diversified our funding. So in addition to getting the money from Open Society foundations, we also turned to the local community and national foundations as well. And people said, you know, OSI who? And that's when we realized that we had to talk a lot more about our mission. And that's really important because we really are motivated by this idea of having an open society, to having a community that's really inclusive, to making sure that everyone feels safe and economically stable enough to participate. And so we also realized that we needed to reach out more to the business sector. That's a sector that many nonprofits really don't engage as much as they should. And that's really too bad because that's where a lot of opportunity rests and also a lot of expertise. So I think we're doing, you know, better in that regard. You know, over the years, I think that we have become better known, particularly in areas where we've been able to engage other partners and a lot of government officials. Some of the issues people just consider underbelly issues. They're not popular. They often really have affected people that have been highly marginalized and often invisible. So for a lot of people who are mainstream or have a lot of power, it's just not something that they recognize, that sort of resonates with them. And I think that we've tried through lots of different media, I mean, whether it's an Instagram account these days or a video or just a very accessible newsletter and trying to have a lot of speaking engagements to really try to help people understand why these are issues that affect everybody. You know, you have a city that has incredible cultural riches, but if you feel nervous about going, you know, to the center of town at night, that's a problem for you. And there are real solutions to that. But people have to sort of recognize the connection. So I think what we've been able to do is sort of connect the dots often. We have a movement now in the whole country where people have finally become aware that we're over-incarcerating people. It's tremendously expensive. We're spending more money incarcerating people than putting money into our education system. And so there's people who just on the sort of dollars and cents of it want to change. That's not actually what motivates us. What we're motivated by is really a question of justice and fairness. You know, if sentences are excessively long for drugs or excessively long for people primarily who are people of color, that's what motivates us to really change that situation. But if people first want to focus on just using public dollars better, we'll go with that, you know, and I think that some of these issues have really attracted attention. Overdose is another good example. You know, we started the overdose program here years ago. We replicated a program that was in Chicago and worked very closely with then Health Commissioner Peter Bailenson to set it up. Everyone has seen that as heroin use, probably stemming particularly by people getting involved with prescription drugs, then not having good access to them, then turning to heroin or getting involved with fentanyl. When those overdoses moved to the counties, there was suddenly lots of articles about it, lots of attention by, you know, top officials. Well, of course, we think there should have been attention all along. At one point, the overdose rate here rivaled our very high murder rate. And so what is that? That, I think, is a result of people being invisible and marginalized. But we will work with all of this. We've worked recently with the health commissioner, who's just wonderful, to develop an overdose program that it's the same overdose program, but it actually has more pieces to it. And to a much greater degree, we now have Narcan, which reverses overdoses. It's now really readily available. We worked particularly with the police department to make sure that the police are carrying Narcan. I think that's also links us then into another issue. I mean, if police come in and they're helpful in the communities, that certainly changes, helps to change relationships with the police and the community. So we do see that some of these issues have become really mainstream issues. I mean, I think after the killing of Freddie Gray, people were really talking about the very things that we focus on all the time: drug addiction treatment, what's going on with incarcerating so many people, the barriers that people face because they have a criminal history when they try to get a job, people who just feel like they're unable to compete for jobs because they didn't stay in school. They felt like there was just nothing there for them, that it was a rational decision to sort of drop out. These are things that now I think across the city people recognize. And that's actually why we are having a solution summit, we call it, on December 10th. So I hope people will participate in that. We feel like it's time now that there's so much more recognition of the problems that we need to collectively focus on the solutions. And we're going to focus on jobs and justice and behavioral health. That's not everything, but it's a really important set of issues. And we hope that we're going to have, on one hand, people who focus on this day in and day out, so practitioners and advocates and researchers. But we also want people who experience these policies and practices and can talk from direct experience about what's wrong and also things that are actually right. And we hope by bringing people together, we actually can focus and choose, literally by voting, on a small number of priorities that we hope our new mayor and our city council, which includes many new, young, energetic people, will focus on during the next year. So we're excited about that. And if people want to hear more about it, we have a website dedicated to it. It's solutionssummitbaltimore.org. And we really do hope people will just show up and participate because voting is tremendously important. We care a lot about civic engagement. That's, I think, one hallmark of an open society. But it's not the only way to participate. Another way is really to make your experiences known and your preferences known. And that's what we're hoping that this Solution Summit will do, so that people will vote. And then the next month, December 10th, they'll be able to really express their points of view.
Things like a Solution Summit, they certainly result in a lot of new creative ideas often, but critics also say, how often do these kinds of summits translate to actual change, and does it just kind of get people's hopes up and then things fall back to the status quo? I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, we're as a foundation, we're painfully aware of that kind of critique and agree with it. One of the things we're going to do is have a paper that they're being drafted now, but they're going to keep on being revised throughout the whole process. And they will include a literature review, because what we didn't want to do is have yet another paper that kind of assesses the situation, because there has been very good work done already. And what we want to do is simply note that in a list of those kinds of studies. So if people want to go with a certain recommendation and there's more information that's already been done in a different report, well, go to that report. Let's not do that research all over again. I think the difference with this one is this insistence we're going to have on choosing. I have been on committees actually several times, for example, to focus on reentry. You know, what kind of things do we need to make reentry successful for people who are leaving prison, and so they can really become stable and part of the community and so forth and not recidivate and so on. But usually those kinds of commissions have had 59 recommendations. It's too much. So we're going to be really insistent that people choose, and that means debate. I mean, at Open Society, we're really into debate. That's why we started the Baltimore Urban Debate League in Baltimore. I think it's just great to have young people just know how to argue for and against. And we've been really thrilled to see that a lot of the young leaders now, post Freddie Gray and even before that, are people who've gone through the Baltimore Debate Program. So we hope that there will be vigorous debate. There's nothing set here. There's not like a set agenda or a set of recommendations. But we really do want to insist on people to choose a limited number of things to press for. And, you know, we hope that the following year, many people throughout the city, not just Open Society, will then advocate for one, two, or more of those priorities, those recommendations. We have, you know, a new administration coming in. It's a big opportunity. There's almost no one in the city who won't agree that this has got to be a moment for change, that we can't keep doing what we have been doing, that it's just been highly destructive. And, you know, Baltimore is yet again known in a very certain way, a negative way nationally. That's not good for business for anyone. It's certainly not good, though, for individual families and so on. And we want to change that. And I think there's more openness to that, more recognition than there ever has been. And we don't want to squander that opportunity. So our hope is that, you know, we don't have all the answers. This is going to be the public voting on priorities. We may not agree, frankly, with every priority that gets chosen. But to the ones that we do agree, we're certainly going to try to monitor what actually happens the next year. If more information is needed, if more manpower is needed, you know, we're going to be willing to do that. And I bet that many people, you know, activists in the city, business people, that they'll be willing to say, okay, to make this happen, what do you need? And I'll help it happen. So I think that's the difference, that it's going to be more specific, and we're just going to ask people to be really disciplined and rigorous and debate as hard as they can about what's really important, but then choose.
Are you hopeful about Baltimore's next chapter?
I am hopeful. You know, I just love this new group of activists that are a part of the city. You know, some people are extremely angry. Some of the young people question, does voting really matter? Is it going to be just more of the same? And I recognize that that's an important question for them to ask. I hope that they obviously decide that it is important to be part of the group that not only votes, but that also builds. I think that we just have some significant talent in the city. And I think the more we recognize who has expertise with what, that we'll be able to use the resources we have really well. You know, this is the wealthiest state in the country. But we also have, you know, in Baltimore, what is it? One out of every four people living in poverty. It is completely, you know, unacceptable. But there are real things that can be done about that. And I feel that the business community is recognizing that they have a role that they can play. And that some of these things have to be negotiated. I mean, partly is that people may start out disagreeing, but people just have to be clear. I mean, this role of debate is really important. People have to state what they want really clearly, and what they believe is simply not good enough. And I feel like that's happening now. And I think that bodes well for the city.
Diana, thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all the other major podcast apps. You can also listen online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble and soundcloud.com/femaletrouble. Follow us on Twitter at FMLTrouble, where we keep you up to date with all of the latest episodes. If you'd like to suggest someone to be featured on the podcast, send me an email at qkelly@baltsun.com. Our theme music is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist, who was actually our first guest on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.